and the economic bloc of five fast-growing economies known as BRICS. Russia says it's hit a Ukrainian military command post in the eastern Pokrovsk region, while Kiev is accused of targeting a residential area. And Israel freezes funds of Palestinian councils in occupied East Al-Quds, a move critics argue will only promote hatred and racism. Welcome everyone to World News. Our top story, Iran's foreign minister has called for cooperation between Tehran and the economic bloc of five fast-growing economies known as BRICS.
The Islamic Republic of Iran is a reliable and effective partner in bilateral and multilateral cooperation due to its unique geostrategic situation and geographical location. It has massive energy sources, especially petroleum and gas, and it has an inexpensive and short transportation channel. The country has young, skilled, and professional workers and new and innovative scientific and technological resources.
Amir Abdullahian made the comment at a meeting in Tehran on prospects for partnership and cooperation between Iran and BRICS. He added, Iran brings an important added value for BRICS members. Iran is now a member of the Friends of BRICS. Now, BRICS consists of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, country with Iran that is seeks to join the bloc to expand its international economic reach. Iran also officially joined the Shanghai Cooperation Organization as its ninth member just over a month ago. We discussed the Tehran Conference on Cooperation between Iran and BRICS and its significance earlier in our news review program. The Iranian president has censured Western nations for breaking their promises regarding Iran's sanction removal talks. Ebrahim Raisi branded Western states as promise breakers, saying past experience has shown they cannot be trusted. He made the remarks in a speech commemorating Iran's National Journalist Day in Tehran. Raisi also emphasized the Islamic Republic's remained and will remain at the negotiating table. He added that Tehran's focal point in the JCPOA is neutralizing cruel sanctions imposed on the country. JCPOA faced a deadlock in 2018 when the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from it. Iran and remaining signatories, though, began talks in April of 2021 to try to revive the accord, but those talks were stalled due to Washington's refusal to provide guarantees not to scrap the deal again. Close relations between Iran and Russia have raised eyebrows in the West. Russian Deputy Foreign Minister now says Moscow and Tehran remain determined to expand cooperation in various fields.
It's fully legitimate and very substantial part of our interaction. It will continue despite all the attempts by our enemies, enemies of Russia and enemies of Iran to disrupt and derail. It will not happen. We have full right to develop and enhance this cooperation and full political resolve to do so. Leaders guide us in this area and bureaucracies, administrations work accordingly. And our military people will also see further contacts and further interaction.
Sergei Ryabkov was speaking in Tehran on the sidelines of a meeting on the prospects for partnership and cooperation between Iran and BRICS. He also touched upon stalled talks on the restoration of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Russian official blamed U.S. and three European signatories to the agreement for a deadlock regarding its revival.
The future of JCPOA truly depends on what our colleagues in the U.S. And in the European Union decide for themselves. I know for sure that our Iranian friends are ready to come back to the original JCPOA with adjustments that were agreed upon for the bulk of it last year. But for reasons unrelated to JCPOA, the Westerners once again abuse the situation and try to squeeze all sorts of irrelevant concessions out of Iran.
Russian Foreign Minister also weighed in on the matter. In a statement, said a failure to implement the JCPOA stems from the erroneous policy of maximum pressure pursued by the U.S. and those who think similarly. The statement also dismissed as unacceptable Western sanctions regime over Iran's nuclear program. Ministry said there is still no reasonable alternative to the implementation of the deal. Thousands of U.S. sailors arrived in the Red Sea as part of a plan to reinforce U.S. military presence in West Asia. Arrival of additional troops came after the U.S. said it's weighing an unprecedented step to deploy combat personnel on commercial vessels in the Persian Gulf.
More than 3,000 United States military personnel have arrived in the Red Sea aboard two warships after Washington said it would boost its military footprint in the region amid rising tensions with Iran. The sailors arrived while traveling on the USS Bataan, an amphibious assault ship that can carry more than 20 aircraft, and on the USS Carter Hall landing ship. Both ships entered the Red Sea after crossing the Mediterranean Sea and passing through the Suez Canal. The reinforcements will secure existing air and naval assets of the 5th Fleet, which is based in Bahrain and operates in the Persian Gulf, the Red Sea, the Gulf of Oman, and the Indian Ocean, including critical strategic choke points in the Strait of Hormuz and Suez Canal. The move follows an announcement last week by U.S. military officials to deploy a security guard composed of Marines on board commercial tankers passing through and near the Strait of Hormuz to form an additional layer of defense for these ships. The U.S. Navy accused Iran of attacking, seizing, or attempting to seize nearly 20 internationally flagged merchant vessels in the region over the past 2 years. However, an informed Iranian defense source has told Iranian media that Tehran has made no efforts to seize oil tankers in the Persian Gulf, denying an earlier U.S. claim accusing Tehran of trying to take control of two ships. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps Navy has over the past years foiled several attacks on both Iranian and foreign tankers in the strategic Persian Gulf region and other high seas. The IRGC's Navy confiscated more than 50 million liters of smuggled fuel, mainly diesel, in various missions last year. That's while the U.S. Navy has seized Iranian ships carrying oil in transit to China in recent months, in an effort to enforce U.S. sanctions on Iran that seek to harm the Islamic Republic's economy. In a Monday press conference, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Nasser Kanani, said U.S. deployments are only serving Washington's interests.
The U.S. government's military presence in the region has never created security. Their interests in this region have always compelled them to feel instability and insecurity. We are deeply convinced that the countries of the Persian Gulf are capable of ensuring their own security.
Iran says it views U.S. military vessels lurking in the waters of the Persian Gulf as a threat to its security and a source of tension and instability in the region.
Iran has time and again said that it and the rest of the countries in the region are responsible for providing maritime security throughout the Persian Gulf. Tensions have been running high between Tehran and Washington as the U.S. has been seeking to boost its military presence in the region.
The U.S. announced last month that it would deploy a destroyer, F-35 and F-16 warplanes to the West Asia. Last week, the U.S. military claimed it was considering putting armed personnel on commercial ships traveling through the Strait of Hormuz to stop Iran from harassing vessels. Tehran responded on Saturday by saying it was equipping its Revolutionary Guards Navy with drones and 1,000-kilometer range missiles. The IRGC also issued a warning to the United States, saying the Islamic Republic is powerful enough to respond in kind to any act of mischief by the U.S. in the region. Also, on 3rd of August, naval forces of the Iranian Islamic Revolution Guards Corps launched surprise military drills in the Persian Gulf islands of Abu Musa, Greater Tomb, and Lesser Tomb. The naval exercise was to display the IRGC Navy's might as well as combat and defense preparedness in protecting the Persian Gulf security and the Iranian islands. During the drills, various units of the IRGC were expected to exercise a range of military tactics. Iranian military experts and engineers have in recent years made remarkable breakthroughs in manufacturing a broad range of indigenous equipment, making the armed forces self-sufficient. Iranian officials have made clear that the country will not hesitate to strengthen its military capabilities, including its missile power, which are entirely meant for defense.
Now, Russia says its forces have struck a Ukrainian military post in the eastern Ukrainian region of Pokrovsk. Announcement by the Russian Defense Ministry came after Ukrainians said Russian missile attack destroyed a civilian building in Pokrovsk. Locals say the missile attack on Monday night killed at least seven people, including rescuers, and wounded scores more. Pokrovsk sits just 40 kilometers from the front line where Moscow is advancing against Ukrainian forces. Kiev began a counteroffensive on the eastern and southern fronts in June, but it's only made modest advances in the face of resistance from Russian forces. Earlier, we spoke to our correspondent in Donetsk, Johnny Miller, for more on the story.
Well, to be totally honest with you, it's difficult to give too much more than what the both sides have been saying without any independent journalists in the small city, Pokrovsk. It's difficult to know for sure exactly what has happened. The Russians say they hit a military command post, a military target. Ukraine says that it wasn't the military target and that civilians and rescuers were killed. My experience of these kind of attacks, it's likely the Russians thought it was a military target. It may well have been a military target. Who was killed? How many casualties? We don't know. Were civilians killed? It does look likely. But often in these attacks, Ukraine often tries to fudge the figures or who was killed. So we don't know too much more than that. We just have to rely on what both sides say.
Israel takes yet another step to add to the sufferings of Palestinians. Regime has now frozen the funds of Palestinian councils and occupied East Al-Quds. Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich announced a freeze of millions of dollars meant for local councils and educational programs, citing crime and safety fears. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has also backed the decision. However, several Israeli officials have strongly criticized the plan, saying it will promote hatred and racism. The five-year funds plan approved back in 2018 was the regime's acknowledgement of years-long social and economic inequality against Palestinians. Israel's oppression of Palestinians has intensified, especially under far-right cabinet of Netanyahu, who assumed office in December. Regime has resorted to all forms of brutal measures, including daily raids, detention, and killing of Palestinians to constrain their activities. Meanwhile, in the occupied West Bank, a bus carrying settlers has come under fire. The incident took place near a Palestinian West Bank village of Safa, just north of Ramallah. According to Israeli media, a vehicle shot at the bus. Israeli forces have now launched a manhunt. This amid a surge in Israeli violence across the occupied West Bank. Weeks ago, regime launched a massive incursion into the Jenin refugee camp, which left over a dozen Palestinians dead. Attacks by Israeli forces and settlers have claimed more than 200 Palestinian lives so far this year. Millions of Afghans are facing hunger, poverty, and displacement as Western countries that once invaded the nation have cut all aid and turned a blind eye to Afghans' plight. Our correspondent in Kabul, Ramatullah Bagban, reports.
Western countries turned their backs on the people of Afghanistan as the NGOs and charities are facing a severe funding gap. Jan Egeland, the head of NRC, in a recent statement has said the NATO countries are turning a blind eye to the plight of the starving Afghan children they left behind, only because the country is not strategically as important as it once used to be. According to some Afghan analysts, Western nations bear responsibility for the challenges endured by the Afghan population and should take corrective measures to address their mistakes.
The plights which Afghan people are facing today are caused mostly by NATO countries, especially the U.S., which invaded our country for 20 years. Today's devastation and crisis in our country are all the results of the U.S. ill policies and decisions. First, they fought a war here, then handed the country to the Taliban, and now they are putting our people under pressure with economic restrictions.
The UN says more than 28 million people in Afghanistan are in dire need of humanitarian aid, especially women and children. Many of them are on the brink of famine and malnutrition. Afghan people say they are awaiting foreign aid for their survival, as they have lost their incomes.
We are not receiving foreign aid anymore. I'm an ordinary worker. I come here every morning to get a job, but no one hires us and we go back home with nothing in our hands. I have a large family and we live in a rented house. I call on the global community not to forget our plight and help us with anything they can. This is the situation of everyone here.
Our sole complaint is that the Western countries created this situation and left us behind. They fueled the war, instability and poverty here and escaped at once. They claim to be sending relief aid, but their small donations are not enough, nor are they reaching qualified people.
This comes as the UK government has been criticized for slashing its aid to Afghanistan by more than half. The US has also frozen Afghan central bank assets and maintained sanctions, paralyzing the economy and other vital infrastructure. After 2 decades of the NATO invasion of Afghanistan, people here are struggling to meet their basic needs. They are calling for more humanitarian aid from wealthy countries and international organizations to mitigate the crisis in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, as a reminder, we made you familiar with the views of Yervant Abrahamian, professor in Princeton, Oxford, and New York universities. Abrahamian is an Armenian from Iranian origin. He has explained his views on the root causes of the Islamic Revolution in his book, Iran Between Two Revolutions, From Constitutionalist to Islamic Revolution. If you remember, it was said that, according to this professor, the reason for Imam Khomeini's high influence on various strata of people was his simplicity and also uncompromising spirit against despotism and bullying. Today, you will become more familiar with Abrahamian's views. Stay tuned, please. Yervant Abrahamian believes that Imam Khomeini, thanks to his sharp mind and full recognition of opportunities, used to unite different opposing groups and mobilize them with the same mottos. In view of this, he pointed to exorbitant concessions granted to the foreign governments, particularly the US, implicit unity with the Zionist regime, skyrocketing arms expenses, very high level of corruption among statesmen and courtiers, destruction of agriculture, rapid spread of slums across the country, and the last but not the least, sorrowful class gap. The professor of American and British universities writes, Ayatollah Khomeini, in attacking the regime, promised to save the country from the yoke of foreigners. He also promised to expand freedom of political parties, guarantee the rights of all religious minorities, and secure social justice for the public. Abrahamian maintains that the Iranian people supported their leader, Imam Khomeini, due to the fact that they had recognized him as their voice and the personification of Imam Ali, the epitome of valor, piety, and political acumen. He writes, during the days leading to the revolution, Pahlavi government had destroyed all political parties and extinguished their main core, but it had failed to overcome mosques and the market. The Iranian-Armenian University lecturer Yervand Abrahamian refers to Imam Khomeini's cleverness to bring the new middle class under the banner of Islamic ideology. He reiterates that Imam Khomeini had assured everyone that the theocracy would never replace autocracy. In the advent of the Islamic Revolution, the Imam stressed that the future government would be both Islamic and democratic, but not in the corrupt sense of democracy, which has caused myriads of problems for most of the Western nations. Father of the Islamic Revolution said that women would have the right to vote equal to men. It was the feat of Imam Khomeini to gather all groups under a single banner through direct assault on the regime and its supporters. As a result, a number of thinkers such as Dr. Shariati found it a good opportunity to join the nationwide uprising and draw the people's attention to the mottos of the Imam, which had awakened the masses. Abrahamian writes that in late 1978, Ayatollah Khomeini was called Imam by almost everyone because they had realized that he could materialize their aspirations like their 12 infallible leaders. Professor Yervand Abrahamian believes that it was Imam Khomeini's great art to bring every strata of the Iranian society under a single cause. Thus, the workers of different factories and industries went on a strike, and most of the economic organizations and institutes went almost bankrupt. Moreover, youths of every city poured to the streets with no fear of the regime and the military. Consequently, people from all walks of life sacrificed their life and blood at the feet of this sacred revolution and helped their unique leader to uproot the corrupt regime and establish a new ruling system, which would guarantee their life and afterlife, inshallah. Dear listeners, next time we will sum up the view of the Iranian-Armenian professor Yervand Abrahamian on Imam Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution. Thank you.
Food for Thought.
Hello everyone, here is some refreshing food for thought from the martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. The real stingy person is the one who refrains from greeting others.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the importance of Salah in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor to be here at your service, dear friends. In today's episode, we are talking about the importance of Salah in our Islamic lifestyle. So, of course, here when we are talking about Salah, we are talking about the wajib obligatory five daily prayers. Now, these five daily prayers, as we just said, are wajib. They are obligatory upon a Muslim. And of course, these wajib obligatory prayers become wajib when a Muslim man or woman reach a certain age, and when they reach a certain maturity physically. And of course, there are a few other requirements, such as being sane and things that are mentioned in the books of the Tawziul Masail, this book which delineates all of the religious edicts and the religious commands and the jurisprudential rulings about different things, including the Salah. Now, the importance of the Salah in our Islamic lifestyle cannot be spoken enough about. As we find in the traditions, this Salah is one of the fundamental pillars of Islam. It can be said that apart from reciting the Kalima Shahada, the statement of La ilaha illallah, Muhammad al-Rasulullah, peace and blessings upon him. This, of course, is the initial proclamation to becoming a Muslim. But after this, the Salah is most probably the fundamental pillar. It is really the litmus test and the gauge of whether an individual is a true Muslim or not, whether an individual is living an Islamic lifestyle or not. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB, English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about Salah, the five daily prayers that are wajib, that must be done by a Muslim. We were talking about how very important this Salah is. We were talking about how fundamental this aspect of a Muslim is. Of course, there are certain requirements which must be met in order for this salah, this daily prayers or namaz, as it is known in the Persian and Urdu languages. This namaz, this salah, comes about and becomes wajib with certain requirements, which you can go and look up. But the very importance of this salah cannot be spoken enough about. This salah is something that helps us, it protects us, it helps to increase our spirituality, it keeps us grounded into and in an Islamic lifestyle. It is an integral part of an Islamic lifestyle, and it is this Islamic lifestyle which, of course, we are trying to inculcate and implement in our daily lives. How can we live an Islamic lifestyle without paying attention to the salah, which is such a fundamental pillar of Islam, and it is such a fundamental pillar of iman? And so we must really try our best to be able to fully implement and practice these wajib obligatory salah and namaz in our Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the beginning, God created light. Based on the old Torah scrolls, Jewish rabbis believe that light was God's first creation. In the 20th century, physicists doubted the nature of light. Was light small particles moving in space, or was it like sea waves? According to Jewish rabbis, water was the second element created by God. Water, with its wave motion, was the first Jewish embodiment of matter. In Jewish mythology, creation was God's will to transform energy into matter. At the beginning of the 20th century, a Jewish scientist from Europe established the equation as his theoretical foundation in physics, a theory in which matter and energy were interchangeable with one another. Albert Einstein, like many other Jewish scientists, immigrated to America with the spread of Nazism and its threat against Jews. At the same time, research into a backlash had begun. This time, instead of the movement of energy to matter, the movement of matter to energy was investigated. This reverse move had the opposite result. If the movement of energy into matter led to creation, the movement of matter into energy had a high power of destruction. A By the way, most of the scientists who noticed this destructive power in America were scientists from the Jewish background. Scientists like Eugene Wigner, Leo Szilard, and Edward Teller. These scientists had migrated from Eastern Europe. They decided to inform the American authorities about the heinous power after feeling the danger that the German Nazis were about to discover the secret of the reverse movement of creation. They wrote to Albert Einstein and asked him to write a letter to the President of the United States. In that letter, he mentioned the destructive power of a newly discovered energy and informed that the Nazis were making a devastating bomb based on this energy. This letter attracted the attention of then-President of the United States, Franklin D. Roosevelt. At that time, only 2 months had passed since the start of World War II, and the United States had still remained neutral. On October 21, 1939, a meeting of the Special Committee to investigate this issue was held with the presence of Jewish scholars, Eugene Wigner, Leo Szilard, and Edward Teller. The result of this meeting was that uranium can be the source of production of bombs that were more destructive than any other material ever experienced in the world. They proposed a budget of $167,000 for uranium research. They mainly studied uranium-235 isotope and a new substance called plutonium. The Americans chose a Jewish physicist from the University of California to lead the bomb production project, J. Robert Oppenheimer. He held various meetings in U.S. universities with many physicists to investigate possibilities and solutions. The American government informed the research group that it would provide them with any kind of financial, human, and logistical assistance. Oppenheimer was a Jew, but he was very interested in Indian mythology. One of the myths was Mahabharata, the national epic of Indians. A part of this epic was called Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu, the Hindu god, wore war clothes and became the destroyer of the worlds. J. Robert Oppenheimer was designing the most destructive weapon in history, and he saw this myth as his source of inspiration. The destroyer of worlds was an inverse reflection of the Jewish creation myth, the return of matter to energy, and the subsequent destruction of the world. On December 18, 1941, Japanese fighter jets attack Pearl Harbor. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Following the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor, the United States declared war on Japan and Germany. U.S. President Franklin D. Roosevelt called his country arsenal of democracy and aroused the emotions of members of Congress with a sensational speech.
Since the unprovoked and dastardly attack by Japan on Sunday, December 7th, 1941, a state of war has existed between the United States and the Japanese Empire.
Franklin D. Roosevelt knew that war was America's first priority from then on. The Japanese were fierce warriors, so the Manhattan Project had already become important for the U.S. At the same time, hatred against Japanese and Germans was being propagated all over America. The U.S. propaganda machine also used Walt Disney animation. The U.S. had entered into chaos. The intense propaganda of the American government for enlistment began. American soldiers went to war in the Pacific Ocean. Some soldiers went to Europe. Humanity experienced the most terrible war until that time, the kind of war that was a direct product of modern times. The Japanese also had a myth similar to the Jews for the creation of the world. In the oldest Japanese legends, the world before creation was nothing but formless matter. Something called chaos. The silence reigned in the time of turmoil and disorder. Suddenly, the sound rose and particles began to move. The movement of particles created light. Thus, light was placed at the highest place in the world, and below it were particles that first created clouds and then heaven. The Japanese concept of light and then cloud had a strange similarity with the Jewish concept of light and then water. The movement of particles in Japanese mythology led to the creation of light energy. The cloud was formed, and under that was heaven. In the modern era, this myth took on a frightening and twisted description. Far from the two fronts of Europe and the Pacific Ocean, the nuclear scientists of America, England, and Canada continued their research in silence. Oak Ridge in Tennessee was the first proposed area for research. The government forcibly seized 56,000 acres of land in this area worth $3.5 million to carry out its research. Later, another 3,000 acres were added to the area. 1,000 families had lost their land under the influence of the government's behavior. Complaints and legal procedures of these citizens against the government did not reach any conclusion, though. Finally, people complained to their Congress representatives, but the Congress investigation could not challenge the government's decision. Some of these families had lived in these properties for generations, but they had to vacate their land within 2 weeks, according to the military order. The Army did not pay the families more than $47 per acre. The villagers had no choice but to sell their land. Oak Ridge nuclear research was mostly theoretical from then on. It seemed the Jewish immigration scientists and Americans still had a long way to go to the practical stage of nuclear fission. But finally, in 1943, the research entered the phase of practical experiments. For several months, the Army and scientists were looking for a suitable place to carry out the experiments. J. Robert Oppenheimer owned a large land in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He suggested conducting the experiments in that area. Jemez Springs in New Mexico was another alternative. But this area was surrounded by Rocky Mountains. Oppenheimer did not like the area and said that in order for the employees not to be afraid, it was better to find a wide and flat area. Finally, Los Alamos was chosen. Oppenheimer went to Los Alamos and was impressed by the beauty of nature. Since then, the beautiful area was a secret laboratory of American nuclear bombs. With the continuous activity of uranium enrichment centers, the United States was finally able to obtain 50 kilograms of uranium-235 with a purity of 89% by July 1945.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
A new report says climate warming in the Arctic has accelerated to 3.7 times global warming rate in 40 years. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times wrote, climate warming in the Arctic has accelerated over the past 40 years with the overall warming rate 3.7 times that of the world over the same period. According to the annual report on polar climate change 2022 released by the China Meteorological Administration, polar regions, the extensive icy regions around the North and South Poles, is a sensitive area and amplifier of global ecological change, and the changes in its climate and atmospheric environment will have an impact on the weather and climate of the globe and the sustainable development of the economy. The Arctic has accelerated its warming over the past 40 years, with the overall warming rate reaching 63 tenths degrees Celsius, 10 years during 1979 to 2022, 3.7 times the global warming rate of 17 tenths degrees Celsius, 10 years during the same period, according to the report. In 2022, the average temperature in the Arctic was 1.10 degrees Celsius, higher than usual. Antarctic temperatures have not changed much compared to the climate average, but this does not mean that climate change in the Antarctic region can be ignored. In fact, the Antarctic Peninsula is still warming at a rate far faster than the global average. Since the late 1970s, Antarctic sea ice extent has experienced a long-term slow growth and began to decrease rapidly in 2014. Data from Fengyun 3 Polar Orbit meteorological satellites show that the monthly average of Antarctic sea ice extent in February and September 2022 is 23.84% and 2.96% smaller than the annual average, among which the summer sea ice extent reached a record low. From 1984 to 2021, the atmospheric concentration of greenhouse gases in the Arctic and Antarctic regions showed a steady upward trend, which is basically consistent with the global trend. Finally, the report also pointed out that the total amount of ozone in the North and South Poles show differential changes. The Antarctic ozone hole area in 2022 is slightly smaller than the year of 2021, the overall continuation of the shrinking trend in recent years, and the area of ozone ranked 12th in history since 1979. In the Arctic, the average Arctic ozone total from the end of December 2022 to March 2023 was unusually high compared to historical levels. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned on July 27th that as the world has been suffering a month of heat with record high temperatures, that the era of global boiling has arrived. Scientists and weather agencies around the world confirm that July is on track to be the world's hottest month on record on Earth in 120,000 years. Global Times added, China is battling with concurrent climate disasters, with both sizzling temperatures and flooding gripping northern parts of the country, while the south is managing the cleanup from Typhoon Doksuri, while at the same time preparing for Hanun, which has already affected more than 724,600 people. As extreme weather takes its toll globally, Chinese experts called on certain countries to set aside their political agenda and take drastic action on international cooperation to curb global warming. Meanwhile, Euronews reported climate change made July hotter for 4 out of 5 humans on Earth. The study also revealed the U.S. cities that are suffering the most from climate change. Human-caused global warming made July hotter 4 out of 5 people on Earth, with more than 2 billion people feeling climate change boosted warmth daily. More than 6.5 billion people, or 81% of the world's population, sweated through at least one day where climate change had a significant effect on the average daily temperature, according to a new report by Climate Central, a science nonprofit. They have found a way to calculate how much climate change has affected daily weather. Climate Central Vice President for Science, Andrew Pershing, said, "We really are experiencing climate change just about everywhere." Researchers looked at 4,711 cities and found climate change fingerprints in 4,019 of them for July, which other scientists said is the hottest month on record. The new study calculated that the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas had made it 3 times more likely to be hotter on at least one day in those cities. In the U.S., where the climate effect was largest in Florida, more than 244 million people felt greater heat due to climate change during July. For 2 billion people in a mostly tropical belt across the globe, climate change made it 3 times more likely to be hotter every single day of July. Those include the million-person cities of San Pedro Sula, Honduras, and Mecca, Saudi Arabia. The day with the most widespread climate change effect was July 10th, when 3.5 billion people experienced extreme heat that had global warming's fingerprints. That's different than the hottest day globally, which was July 7th, according to the University of Maine's Climate Reanalyzer. The study is not peer-reviewed, the gold standard for science, because the month just ended. It is based on peer-reviewed climate fingerprinting methods that are used by other groups and are considered technically valid by the National Academy of Sciences. Two outside climate scientists told the Associated Press that they found the study to be credible. Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Over the past few weeks, we've seen unprecedented popular and official mobilization from Muslims in the West and the Muslim world against the desecration of our beloved holy book, the glorious Quran. After repeated burnings of the Quran in Sweden and Denmark, there have been huge protests in virtually all Muslim-majority nations, as well as the launching of boycott campaigns and diplomatic action against these European powers. And now there are signs that these acts of resistance have begun to bear fruit, with both the Danish and Swedish authorities giving strong indications that they will ban Quran burnings, inshallah. A few days ago, I travelled to Denmark to interview a lady whose actions have gone viral across the world. When Quds al-Samarai saw the Quran being burned in Copenhagen, she moved to protect the holy book and was assaulted by far-right extremists and the police for her trouble. Here's her story.
I was walking past and I saw the Quran being burnt, so I put it out. And then he hit me really hard, so I moved back and he strangled me, pulling me down. I had no idea what was going on, but I looked over and I see another Quran with a shoe on it. I could not comprehend the idea of a shoe being on our holy Quran. So I ran over without thinking of any consequences to protect it. Then the man hit me and strangled me again. He also had a glass beer bottle, which he threatened me with. So then I shouted, "Police! Police!" But no one came to help. Usually here in Denmark, when you shout police, they come quickly, ready to help, but not in my case. I was shouting for 5 minutes. No police or even people came to help. I don't know where everyone disappeared at this time. After 5 minutes, the police turned up. When they came, I couldn't remember who the guys who hit me were. The police took the Quran off me. But I said, "No, please, they will burn it." They used foul language against Islam and were shouting foul language at me. Then they were shouting to the police that I stole their property. I think it's because he was scared, because he knows he would get in trouble for hitting me. So he had to twist the story in his favor. As soon as the police heard the word stole, they put me in handcuffs immediately. And right in front of me, they gave him back the Quran. The police had no idea what happened, so they sat me down and said, "What's going on then?" I told him that I saw the Holy Quran being burnt, so I protected it by putting out the fire and trying to remove the shoes off the Quran. But it turned out it was nailed onto the Quran, so I grabbed the shoes. Both the shoes and the Quran came off the, so I held on to it. This is where it looked like I was stealing. But all I wanted to do was take off the shoes and protect the Quran. All I wanted to do was protect our loved Quran, but the man punched me repeatedly, strangled me. The police replied with, "Okay, so you stole it." I said, "No, I did not steal. I'm protecting our Quran." He replied, "It's their freedom of speech, which they are entitled to. You are in the wrong." So I replied, "Well, it's my freedom of speech to protect the Quran by putting out the fire and removing the shoes." I told the police, "I can't sit back and watch my Quran being burnt." He replied, "It's not yours, it's his." I said, "No, but he's not allowed to burn it." He said, "He is, it's his freedom of speech. You can even do the same." I told him, "No, us Muslims will never burn or disrespect any religious books. As a Muslim, I could not sit back and allow this to happen. I did not want to steal anything. I just wanted to remove the shoe. You speak of freedom of speech. This is my freedom of speech." I told the police officer, "Should I go to the station and make a complaint about being hit?" He said, "No, don't worry, we will contact you."